Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hi, this is Jay Richards of Discovery Institute, and I am joined again by Mike Keyes. We have been doing a series on the Cosmos Possible Worlds series, commenting not on every episode, but on those that we think might be interesting to ID the Future. And for those of you who don't know, the Cosmos Possible Worlds series is actually the third version of this famous Cosmos series. It started back in 1980 with late astronomer Carl Sagan, and then there was a reboot of it that was out a few years ago with astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson. And then this third Cosmos series called Possible Worlds is also with Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's on the National Geographic Channel. And there are, I think, about 13 episodes, and we have talked about quite a number. And so this is part of that series. And today with Mike Keyes, we're going to talk about episode 8. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Good to be with you, Jay.
Well, this episode, why don't you just start by giving us a kind of 30,000 foot view of this episode 8 of Tyson's National Geographic series. What happens in this episode?
Well, like usual, he has got some great ways of communicating the meaning of the cosmos, at least from his perspective. He's a great communicator. He wants to tell you that the cosmos is worth investigating. It's interesting. We can know it. And so there's a lot of optimism about our ability to know the world. But he also has these stories that he inserts about the history of science that get him off track from the truth. And so that's the part that I was particularly concerned in, since I'm a historian of science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what does he talk about here in episode 8 specifically? I know there's something about Copernicus, right?
Yeah. And of course, Copernicus came up with the first systematic sun-centered astronomy that was mathematically complete. It was quite an achievement. You know, the older Earth-centered view still worked to make predictions of where the planets would be. But there were certain advantages to this new sun-centered system, even though it couldn't be proven yet. But Tyson is particularly interested in the kind of the cultural or even spiritual implications, as he sees it, of this transition from an Earth-centered to a sun-centered astronomical viewpoint.
Okay, so just to remind, we're talking about sort of Western astronomy for a millennium and a half or so had this Ptolemaic Aristotelian cosmology, right, in which you've got Earth in the center, so to speak, and then you've got these concentric spheres with the moon and the sun and the visible planets and then stars. And so then Copernicus represents this shift when he writes his book, and I think is it 1543, and that suggests, no, in fact, the sun is the so-called center of the universe. This is something that, of course, people that know history of science will be familiar with, but it's also, for those of us that write on this subject, a source of a lot of mythology in terms of the interpretation of what Copernicus saw himself as doing and what he in fact did. So how does Tyson present this episode?
Well, predictably, Jay, he frames the Copernican story as a humongous demotion for humanity from a privileged center to an unprivileged peripheral position, no longer in the center of some divine plan for humans in the cosmos. And some of the new atheists have chimed in on this, like Christopher Hitchens, you know, claiming it was Christianity's greatest failure to oppose the Copernican view because of its alleged human dethroning characteristics. But they're getting the story wrong, Jay, even though the story is easy to tell and it sounds like, of course, that's true, but they get the story wrong.
Well, first of all, give me the wrong story and then let's talk about the true story. So what's the wrong story is essentially that the meaning of the center in the pre-Copernican view being in the center, I'm doing the little air quotes right here, but nobody can see it, right? That center was the most privileged place to be, so that then by Copernicus making us a planet rather than the quote center, he has profoundly demoted us. And then this, of course, is an episode in this kind of larger narrative that as science progresses, it causes us to realize just how insignificant we are. Well, what's the correct story if that's the wrong one?
Yeah, the correct story is that the received wisdom at the time of Copernicus and also Galileo and Kepler, you know, this early modern period in the Western tradition, was that the center of the universe was not the place of honor, but going clear back to Aristotle, and even a little bit further back, it was considered that this was the bottom of the universe where the ordinary terrestrial elements of earth, water, air, and fire get together and make things and then come apart and causing corruption. You know, things die, things fall apart. And that the center of the universe is better described as the bottom of the universe, whereas up, away from the center, was the exalted heavens,
right,
considered to be made out of an incorruptible fifth element, which of course has been debunked, but that was the received wisdom at the time. And so to reconceive of this as Earth being away from the center, actually joining the dance of the stars, if you will, could be easily framed in that cultural context as a promotion rather than as a demotion.
Well, and this is, it's extraordinary because even someone that doesn't know astronomy, if they know Aristotelian philosophy and physics, would realize this, this quintessence, this fifth element, you know, the moon and above, these unchanging elements. I mean, these are the heavenly spheres, especially when Christianized, you've got God is not in the center, right? He's up in the heavens. And so that sort of seems obvious that the meaning of the center is completely different in this pre-Copernican cosmology than in this Copernican story. But I guess that to play the devil's advocate, I mean, how did, say, Galileo and Kepler themselves, the sort of famous Copernicans that followed Copernicus, how did they see it? I mean, how did they actually interpret this?
Well, Galileo, in one of his books, argues about how the light reflected off the moon from the earth, actually the sun hits the earth and then goes back to the moon. It shows that the earth can also reflect light like the other planets, and it therefore, by analogy, might be considered a planet. And he argues that, he says, I will prove that earth does have motion, that it moves, and it's not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. It's not the bottom, the dumpster of the universe. So he framed it as a promotion. Now, he and others eventually discarded the old Aristotelian framework that made it the bottom of the universe, the trash heap. But at the time, he framed his innovation as a promotion that it's no longer in the place that was traditionally considered the bottom, the place of dishonor. And of course, Kepler went even further than that. You want to hear that one?
Yeah, exactly. I know. I was hoping you'd get to Kepler because he's great on this.
Yeah, and especially for you, Jay, because you and Guillermo Gonzalez published the book Privileged Planet, where you have actually a quite good historical chapter that shows that Kepler was one of the early proponents of a kind of design for discovery thesis that you present in the Privileged Planet. And here's the way it goes. For him, he once wrote that we could not remain at rest in the center because of that contemplation, he meant science, for which man was created, which includes being able to measure distances to planets like, say, Venus. And if Earth is considered a moving object and it has an orbit larger than Venus's, then you can easily draw a triangle out at key positions using the fundamental properties of triangles, figure out how far Venus is from the sun compared to how far Earth is. And it's pretty straightforward trigonometry.
Yeah.
So, but Kepler actually argued that a moving Earth, as opposed to one in the dead center, was privilege for science, that we can make objective measurements that we couldn't otherwise make if we were stuck in the center and not a moving target. Kind of like how surveyors will triangulate by taking two different positions and then seeing a distant object and then measuring the angles and being able to calculate how far that object is. The same mathematical principles are at work here. And Kepler realized that and actually argued that God would more likely have made Earth a moving planet so that we could be more adept at doing science, which is, of course, and which is what you argue in the Privileged Planet book on a much more extensive basis, don't you?
Yeah, but I can tell you that when Guillermo and I found that quote from Kepler, we were delighted because we were sort of struggled a little bit. We thought, now surely somebody else has made this argument that God's designed the universe, you know, for discovery and for science. So we were really glad to find it in Kepler. And I know, of course, there was also this interesting philosophical background. You had the pre-Copernican Aristotelian view, and then I know both Kepler and Galileo were a part of a Neoplatonic resurgence, and so there might have been a reason why they would be sort of interested in the sun. And that's sort of the background. You can never count on any kind of cartoonish history of science to give you any of that. But I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems so straightforward. And you write about this in your book, Unbelievable, which I recommend to listeners in detail. Of course, Guillermo and I talk a little bit, we have a whole chapter on it, or one chapter rather, in the Privileged Planet. C.S. Lewis was very good on this. Basically, anyone that's really historically literate should be able to figure out that this textbook cartoon about the Copernican Revolution is not true. So, I mean, do you know as a historian, when exactly did this kind of become the conventional wisdom so that astronomers and astronomy textbooks could just tell this story with impunity, apparently?
Well, it has its early roots in basically the generation after Kepler and Galileo. Fontenelle, French guy, was one of the early proponents of this false story. And eventually it got into the astronomy textbooks. And by the 1960s or so, it became the dominant sort of storyline in astronomy textbooks. And they would extend this to other discoveries and frame them as sort of serial demotions, like, well, we're not in the center of the galaxy either, which, as you know, by the way, would be a very bad place to be. But anyway.
Thank God. Yeah, that's right.
Or, you know, and so, or you know, that ordinary matter is very uncommon. The most matter is, you know, dark matter or whatever. And so the matter we're made out of is not as central as the other kind of matter. You know, you could take just any kind of discovery and figure out some way to finagle it to make it sound like it's demotion for humanity. And that's the kind of the basic storyline that most astronomy textbooks have pushed. And of course, it goes back to this false history, but it affects the way that students today interpret data, because it makes it sound like, well, yeah, it's one more of these, you know, demotions.
Yep. One more demotion. And I mean, it is a philosophical point, of course. A physical location is metaphysically ambiguous. You know, it's not like, okay, in all cases, being in the center is a good thing. The example you gave a minute ago of the galaxy, right? It's the very last place you'd want to be in a spiral galaxy would actually be in the middle of it. And so it seems like such a simple point that, look, physical location and metaphysical significance are distinct things, and it depends upon the framework you're working in as to whether it's a good or a bad thing to be in the center or not. But I guess this idea that humans are not significant, somehow, at least for materialists and atheists, it seems like it's a really important part of the story that they want to tell. I mean, I assume what they're thinking of is the Christian story and the biblical story in which God creates everything. He doesn't just create humans, but then he creates humans as this sort of crowning achievement, even though he tells Job in the Old Testament, you're not the only reason why I created the world. I did a bunch of stuff and you don't know anything about it. Nevertheless, there's this idea that, well, Christians and Jews and religious people think humans are somehow special. And so we have some vested interest in demoting human beings and showing us, arguing how insignificant we are. I mean, is that the whole story of atheists generally settled for that? Or is there maybe a narrative of hope, kind of a replacement on offer by people like Tyson?
Well, you know, one of the things I do in my book, Unbelievable, is show that in popular science writing, and that's what we're talking about, Tyson, Nye, even textbooks or in some ways popularizations of science, what they do is they allegedly disabuse us of religious myths, which they in fact don't do, but they allegedly do that. They typically replace traditional myths with their own sort of worldview shaping story or myth in that anthropological sense. And Tyson, for example, who's the host of the Cosmos series, both on that series as well as in various other places like a textbook forward and a very, very prominent textbook called The Cosmic Perspective, using a kind of a trademark term, The Cosmic Perspective, which Tyson likes to use. He says, well, the cosmic perspective, in other words, the scientific one on the universe, is, well, the universe is not a benevolent cradle designed to nurture life, he writes. And it's childish to think that, you know, everything revolves around us. But we are special because we can do science. That's what he argues. And we are the universe becoming aware of itself. And so there's this kind of awakening of the universe, you know, the force awakens, right, Jay? Right. And here we are, and we're the universe becomes self-conscious. And that's what makes a significance, especially if you put us alongside alleged extraterrestrial life, that the universe has become conscious perhaps many times. And that's what makes us important. So they do have this replacement narrative, this replacement myth, that they think gives us some kind of meaning.
So it's sort of a take with one hand and then try to give back with the other. And I noticed this, there's this kind of, I don't know, it's a kind of metaphysical schizophrenia. I mean, you saw this in Carl Sagan as well, who insisted on this false Copernican myth of man's insignificance, but then also spoke spiritually about nature and about science and that sort of thing. So they want to imbue meaning and significance in some other way. So it sounds like humanity is insignificant, but scientists are significant or something like that. Yeah, or the scientific pursuit is significant. And so this really is, I mean, there's a sort of atheist futurist mythology and religion that's part of this. And I mean, I think honestly, that's not the problem. The problem is that, of course, these guys claim that their science is sort of metaphysically neutral. And in fact, everybody recognizes that when you're talking about the origins of the universe and the place of man in the universe, these are richly philosophical and metaphysical questions on which presumably science can speak. And I think a healthier attitude would be, let's have a good debate about that. You know, unfortunately, of course, Tyson sticks with the really, really simple argument. So I guess we'll have to look elsewhere for really good arguments on the other side. But a lot of fodder for us. I've been talking with Mike Keyes about the Neil deGrasse Tyson series, Cosmos Possible Worlds, which you can see on the National Geographic channel. And today we have been talking about episode 8 and its treatment of Copernicus. This is Jay Richards. Thanks so much for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.